From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Jon Stewart hosts The Daily Show, a fake news program on Comedy Central, but he recently finished fourth in a journalist's poll of the nation's best political reporters. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Jon Stewart about covering the election, what The Daily Show does that straight journalists can't, and about their new book, America, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. Also, we visit and go to the Internet. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the words we use to talk about the web and how they reflect the way we think about it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Insurgents set off three car bombs today in southern Baghdad, killing more than 40 people, most of them children. NPR's Peter Kenyon says the main attack was aimed at a government-sponsored celebration.
One reason for the crowd was a reopening of a sewage pumping station. It's one of a large number of reconstruction projects that are underway. This was a fairly happy occasion. It was supposed to be a happy occasion to get the sewage system back up and running in this neighborhood. American officials have said in the past that they are sometimes quite wary about announcing these events, these openings, for this very reason, that they can become targets. I know when electrical stations are reopened, they very often do not announce it because they're afraid it will then become a target for the insurgency.
NPR's Peter Kenyon in Baghdad. A third car bomb exploded near an Iraqi National Guard checkpoint about a mile from the first attacks. A U.S. military spokesman said 10 American soldiers were wounded. The situation in Iraq is expected to be a main topic as President Bush and Senator John Kerry meet tonight in the first of three encounters. Tonight's nationally televised events will focus on foreign policy, the war, and terrorism. It's expected to draw an audience of as many as 40 million viewers. The event will be staged under a rigid set of rules negotiated by the two campaigns. Candidates will be held to strict time limits. They won't be able to move around the stage to ask each other direct questions or to demand pledges from each other. At least 23 Palestinians and three Israelis were killed today in the Gaza Strip. Israeli troops launched an incursion deep into a Gaza refugee camp after a rocket attack killed two Israeli children. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
In the single deadliest incident in Gaza today, an Israeli tank shell killed at least seven Palestinians near a school in the Jabalia refugee camp in the northern Gaza Strip. Palestinian witnesses said the dead from the tank shell blast were all teenagers with no involvement in the heavy fighting that raged through the densely populated refugee camp. An Israeli army spokesman said a tank fired at armed men after they detonated a bomb that wounded several Israeli soldiers. Earlier, Palestinian gunmen shot dead two Israeli soldiers and a woman jogging, and Israeli troops killed 16 people, including Palestinian militants and bystanders. Israeli tanks and troops rolled into the Jabalia refugee camp after a Qassam rocket attack Wednesday killed two Israeli children, aged 2 and 4. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 56 points to close at 10,080. The Nasdaq gained 3 points to close at 1896. This is NPR News. Things are slowly returning to normal in some parts of Florida hit by Hurricanes Francis and Jean, but some schools in the Fort Pierce area may be closed for a while. Jill Roberts reports from member station WQCS.
The St. Lucie County School District sustained substantial damage from Francis and even more from Jean. Superintendent Michael Lannon estimates the final dollar figure could reach $25 million, including $2 million to have all schools cleaned of mold.
The flooding that took place, if anyone's been to Lincoln Park School, inside the middle school corridors were lakes. We're replacing over 500 windows. Every window brought water into our schools. Every one of our schools had water intrusion.
The district has begun publishing daily lesson plans in the local paper so parents can work with children at home. Because of the hurricanes, students attended school only one day during the month of September. For NPR News, I'm Jill Roberts in Fort Pierce, Florida.
The Russian cabinet has approved the Kyoto Protocol, designed to cut emissions of so-called greenhouse gases and slow global warming. The treaty now goes to the Russian parliament, where it's expected to win easy approval from supporters of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Russian opponents of the treaty argued that the standards would force the shutdown of some of the country's heavy industries and wouldn't help the environment. Russia's approval is key to the implementation of the treaty, which doesn't become binding until it's been ratified by countries that account for 55% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions. The U.S. withdrew from the agreement after President Bush rejected it in 2001. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Walmart, bringing communities job opportunities, goods and services, and support for neighborhood programs. On the web at walmartstores.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest Jon Stewart isn't a real news anchor. He just plays one on TV. But he's pretty good at it. In 5 years as host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central, Stewart's quick wit, biting satire, and political savvy have taken the once obscure fake news show and turned it into an influential voice in American politics. It's now one of the top stops for politicians and newsmakers. John Kerry, President Clinton, Pat Buchanan, and Richard Clark have all recently appeared on the show. The program won a Peabody Award for its coverage of the 2000 presidential campaign and recently won two Emmys. Stewart and the Daily Show writers have just published a new book called America, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. John Stewart started doing stand-up in the mid-'80s. He hosted a show on MTV, did an HBO special, and had small parts in several movies before joining The Daily Show in 1999. Let's listen to a piece of a Daily Show newscast from a couple of weeks ago. This is part of their coverage of the war in Iraq, which they call Mesopotamia.
This week, Iraqi leader Iyad Alawi took a welcome vacation from this to enjoy a couple of days of this. Yay! This morning, Alawi spoke before a joint session of Congress to give a progress report on his country, because who better to give an objective assessment of Iraq than the man we hand chose to lead it?
My friends, today we are better off, you are better off, and the world is better off without Saddam Hussein.
Alawi gave an optimistic picture of his country's future.
I stand here today as the prime minister of a country emerging finally from dark ages of violence, aggression, corruption, and greed.
Corruption and greed? Is Halliburton leaving?
Well, John Stewart, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Do you have as much fun doing that show as it looks like you're having?
No.
No.
Let me explain something. Our entire day is focused on taking the unfun we have, making it, and turning it into fun when it gets on the air. Because we function actually very similarly probably to a news show, in that we have sort of an editorial meeting in the morning. It's a really structured day. We actually do have a very good time doing it, but it's sort of relentless, and it's a lot of the structure of our day is a lot more rigid, I think, than people would imagine.
You start by reading the New York Times, The Economist, everything, watching a million news clips?
No, we get most of our news from the tickers on the top of cabs. So it starts from that. Our day usually starts with sports scores.
Building it from the ground up, right.
Exactly. We normally, you know, the papers are not, it's not like we come in at 8:30 and start reading the paper and go, ooh, this story's interesting. I mean, we're working, the beautiful thing about faking a news show is the topicality is delayed. And the truth is, it helps us more to have saturation of a news story, because then everybody's very familiar with the parameters of it. So we generally are working a day or two ahead.
Yeah, you got
at least at our best.
You got a chance to do the Howard Dean scream after everybody had already heard it.
Yes, although we didn't do it, I think, as much as what you would imagine the other news organizations. Unfortunately for us, things that are absurd, on its face value, things that are funny don't really help us as much as, you know, Fabio on a roller coaster getting hit in the face with a bird doesn't really help us as much as Alawi speaking to a joint session of Congress.
Telling us that corruption is leaving his country, right.
Yes, exactly. So it's things that are inherently amusing are not as interesting to us.
How much of it do you write? How much of it do your writers come up with?
I write the entire program. What I like to do is come in, write the entire program, and treat my staff to hot stone massages.
That's boy.
It's just how I like to work. Yeah. I'll come in around 7, have half a grapefruit, do some jazzercise, and then just get to writing.
God, you are as decent a man as we thought.
Oh, it's absolutely unbelievable. We have an unbelievable staff of writers, and Ben Carlin, the executive producer, DJ Jabberbaum, who's the head writer, and then all the writers, the correspondents. I mean, for me, I can literally show up at 5 pretty drunk, and as long as the show is spelled out phonetically on the prompter, you know, I'll do okay. Just have to face the right direction. Well, I sort of function as, in some respects, in the same way you would imagine the anchor functions as a managing editor type.
Was there a point at which, you know, in recent years, you suddenly realized that all of the A-list celebrities and newsmakers wanted to be on the show? I mean, you've had an incredible run of people coming onto the show.
We find that the biggest stars, the most powerful people, want desperately to be on the most obscure cable channel they can find. It's just something that they want. It gives them a sense of adventure. We're like Outward Bound. You know, to find our show, you have to go past Spanish people playing soccer. It's right. Not something that, you know, you just fall upon.
I want to talk a bit about the celebrity interview thing you've done. And we've all got right, a clip here of a big, big celebrity. This was former President Bill Clinton. And I wondered if you were at all nervous about meeting him, since you guys were so naturally kind of even-handed and tasteful during the Lewinsky scandal.
I was not in any way. You know, I actually got there pretty much at the back end, if you pardon the expression, of the Lewinsky scandal. So I was not as responsible for the prevalence right. of jokes. But, I mean, the truth is, right. at a certain point, I would imagine he's kind of numb to sexual innuendo and everything else. So I don't imagine that, you know, if he were to avoid contact with all those who made Lewinsky jokes, I don't imagine he would be going out very often.
Right. All right, well, let's hear this. And I'll just say for our audience that this is the beginning of the Clinton interview, and it's followed a set in which you've sort of had some fun with the Swift Boat veterans attacking John Kerry's war record. This is John Stewart interviewing former President Bill Clinton.
Thank you for coming. Nice to see you.
I'm glad to see you.
Thank you so much for coming on the program.
I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad you did that riff on the military attack on Kerry, too.
That was a rough one, wasn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, they did the same thing to McCain in 2000.
Same group, am I right?
It's the same group.
Nice kids.
Yeah. In support of the same crowd, I might point out.
Right. Who had nothing to do with it. No.
They also pointed out they had a calling operation in South Carolina in the primary in 2000, talking about how John McCain had a black baby, and they didn't want the white voters to forget it.
Right. They actually meant Strom Thurmond. It's just they had the wrong name.
That's right. They did.
That's John Stewart speaking with Bill Clinton. You know, that line is still funny to me. And when I saw it live, I thought there's no way that he got an ex-president to set him up for that line.
No, Bill and I actually, we call each other sort of at night, you know, and I said to him, what are you going to wear? And he said, what are you going to wear? And then we'd sort of go over our riffs, kind of Abbott and Costello-y.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think a lot of TV interview shows, I mean, people do kind of, there's some planning going on between producers. We'll talk about this, you talk about that, so you have a chance to prep.
Right.
I mean, you just snapped that line off, like, and it made me think of the pressure of you there with 4 or 5 minutes with a celebrity. And, you know, in most interview programs, there's a lot of ways to do a good interview. The guest can say something new, they can say something revealing about themselves, or they can be funny.
Right.
But this is Comedy Central, and you've got to give us a laugh every 45 seconds. Is that pressure?
It would be pressure if that weren't the only thing I was good at. You know, if the pressure was to come up with actually something insightful and intellectually stimulating and emotionally honest, yeah, that would be pressure. But if the concept is to come up with a wisecrack every 45 seconds, it's really the only thing that I've been trained for. So in some respects, it's not pressure. The pressure is when the expectation is that something other than that is going to occur, and that's probably when my lack of professionalism shows more openly than during things like that when I'm doing wisecracks.
Well, I think you're selling yourself a little short there, and we're going to get
Hey, I'll do this short selling here, young man.
All right. Lowered expectations is part of the political game.
That's exactly right.
But I guess the other thing I wanted to ask is, you've got a new baby at home, born in July.
What? Oh, my God, I've got to go. Wait, how often do you have to feed those?
No, you do have a wife, Tracy, and I imagine you have some help.
Yes.
But are there times you come in?
What else are you imagining about our lives? I imagine you have a fountain made of marble, and I imagine the walls are gilded in gold.
I'm thinking like an illegal immigrant there helping out around the house or something. I don't know.
Now, why does it have to be illegal?
You're a celebrity.
All right.
But I wonder if you come in sleep deprived sometimes, and that makes it a little tougher to, I don't know, to do what you do.
I think doing what we do actually is enhanced by a certain sleep deprivation, because it's the part of your brain that you're not really in touch with until something's desperately wrong. It is relentless, but the nice part about working with a very talented group of people is, you know, on a daily basis, not everybody's bringing their A game every day, but there's always somebody there to sort of bring a little bit of inspiration or a little bit of something else. I consider one of my better talents to be recognizing a good idea when I hear it. Mm-hmm. One of the most important things to be able to do in a show like this that is so relentless in terms of its production schedule is to be able to recognize, you know, when your idea isn't it and when someone else has it, and be able to quickly run with that.
My guest is Jon Stewart. He is the host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central, and he has a new book out, America the Book, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Jon Stewart. He is the host of Comedy Central's Daily Show, and he has a new book out. He and the staff have done a history of democracy, America, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. There was recently the Columbia Journalism Review, one of the most respected journalism publications in the country, had a website in which they asked their readers to poll those who were doing the best at covering the presidential campaign. You came in fourth. Well above people in the New York Times and other better-known publications.
Yes. Now, that is either a terrible statement about the state of news in our country or the state of comedy on our program. I'm not sure which. Probably both.
All right. Well, I want to play a clip that might give us a little insight into why someone might mistake you for a journalist. And this is you interviewing former Republican Congressman Henry Bonilla. And I believe this was during the time of Democratic National Convention, and he was a part of the Republicans' rapid response team. So let's listen to Jon Stewart interviewing former Republican Congressman Henry Bonilla.
But so I turn on the TV and they say, he's the first most liberal senator, John Edwards is the fourth most liberal senator.
Right.
So the only thing, because I watch that at home and I'm stupid. How do they figure that?
We have votes and bills that we sponsor, and they track.
I'm not retarded. How do they compile?
They list them. You take a list.
But who's they?
These groups that I told you about.
Which one is the one that said they're the first and the fourth?
You take the trial lawyers or the people that follow the union votes and the people who follow the small business votes or the corporate votes, and
right.
They all go, you're either with us 100% of the time or none, 0% of the time, and they kind of average them all together.
Who?
These groups do.
But which one, when you say first most liberal and fourth most liberal, what is the group and how is it, because I'm not...
No, I hope I'm explaining it clearly.
I don't think
okay.
so.
That's very funny stuff, but this was a real interrogation. I mean, you were doing what journalists do there.
No, I think I actually was doing what journalists don't do. I think that's why I voted high. Isn't that the issue? The journalists don't do that. That basically, when you're, and I'm not talking about print, but isn't the issue that on television, those sorts of operatives for both political parties go on the air and say, John Kerry's the first most liberal, or the new jobs created are $9,000 less. And nobody ever says, I'm sorry, I don't mean to stop you, but what? What was that? Where do you come up with these numbers?
Right. But, I mean, do you feel yourself getting pulled into doing a job that journalists ought to be doing? I mean...
No. I don't, because I feel myself being pulled into areas that strike me as of interest to me. And that strikes me as an area of interest that so many of these, you know, these political parties, it's very interesting, but they've, you know, they are basically dedicated to figuring out how to game the system. And they have found, I think, the real vulnerability in our media. And they are exploiting that loophole. And the vulnerability is twofold. One is the pace at which the 24-hour networks have. So it's sort of their deadline pressure. And the other is that the anchors are not versed in an expertise of news. They are TV people. And so those two together form sort of a conspiracy of a non-aggression pact, if you will. And it allows these talking point robots, operatives from different political parties, to go on these shows and basically lay it out there without question. And it's done to influence people through repetition.
So deceptive content never gets challenged. Nobody ever gets to the bottom of it.
I wouldn't say never, but the prevailing sense is that if it is challenged, it's in print and a week later when the information is available. And if I know it, it's clearly available because I'm not exactly, you know, I'm not like one of the old guys with a metal detector on the beach searching for, like, it's there on my computer pretty much when I boot it up.
But I guess what a producer of a talk show or Crossfire might say is, but, you know, in the great marketplace of ideas, our solution is to provide competition. The other side is always there, and if one side has phony talking points, the other side's right there. Doesn't that work?
Doesn't seem to be. I mean, but that's not in the marketplace of ideas. From what I understand, there aren't only two products available. Mm-hmm. So if that's like saying, you know, fair competition is soda machines with only Coke and Pepsi in them. It's not the case that it is a free marketplace of ideas. And the other side of it is, what is the expertise of the anchor? What is your role then? That's like saying the referee for a football game is just there to make sure no one dies. You know, there are, should be, you know, truths, actual truths, and someone should be there to help arbitrate that. And it seems to be that media should be the forum for that. For instance, on Crossfire, I'm not sure what those guys are doing there other than egging their own side on. Mm-hmm. And if anything, I think that puts out misinformation or disinformation because it vouches for deception. By allowing it on television, you are vouching for it. You're saying, these people, we've done a background check. They're okay. It's like the Swift Boat veteran guys. They go right on TV.
Right, they're granted the credibility of wide access, right?
Absolutely. They're granted the credibility of, and it's not enough to bring someone on from the Democratic side, which, and say, well, actually, this isn't true. Someone has to earn some credibility here, don't they? Isn't that the role of the anchor, or is the anchor just a tool?
Well, you know, somebody I know, after seeing you eviscerate the Swift Boat veterans in one of the pieces that you did on The Daily Show, mm-hmm. yelled at the television, the Kerry campaign ought to buy this stuff. They ought to put on, that's what they ought to be using. Are you selling?
Sorry?
Okay, I said, are you selling? I mean, would you give it? I mean, how would you feel about your material being used for a partisan purpose? I mean, good luck to you.
If you feel like comedy program bits are your best effort as far as selling your candidate, good luck to you. You know, I think that the difficulty here is they're doing the same thing. Our role is to make it as funny and smart as we can possibly make it, but base it upon something that is frustrating for us to watch. And it's frustrating for me. You know, I watch these 24-hour news networks all day long. You know, it's because I night manage a Bennigan's, and I just happen to have it on.
But what a life!
No, it's really quite incredible. But in general, you know, I think it's they have abdicated their role. You know, politicians are doing, of course they're doing what they do. They're trying to get away with as much as they can get away. But what I'm saying is political parties are working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, to find the loopholes and vulnerabilities in the media system. And the media has to be better. The problem is the media isn't monolithic. We sort of keep talking about the media. And unfortunately, it's a series of these fiefdoms. And they have figured out how to play these fiefdoms off against each other. It's that competition. If you question us on our talking points. Here's an example. I was watching during the Republican convention, Dick Cheney's daughter, and not the one that they hide, the other one, was on, I think it was Anderson Cooper's show. And she was doing the Republican talking points about John Kerry and the thing. And Anderson Cooper, to his credit, stopped her and said, well, you know, to be fair, you're sort of taking that out of context then. And literally, he interrupted twice, and she said, very angrily, what are you, a surrogate? And I thought, wow, is that where we've gotten? We've gotten to the point where if an anchor interrupts a talking point, you accuse them of being an operative, which, by the way, is also a strategy to discredit the person that disagrees with you. The other example was Zell Miller went on a Hardball after his relatively insane rant. That if you listen to without the picture, reminded you very much of Strom Thurmond's famous 1948 speech, but not in content so much as delivery. Uh-huh. But so Chris Matthews questioned him on, you really think John Kerry would defend this country with spitballs? And Zell Miller was so upset at being questioned, he challenged Chris Matthews to a duel, mm-hmm. which is basically, you know, the idea is if the news media questions my talking points, I will threaten to kill you. I mean, that's, you know, these politicians are so unaccustomed to interrupted spin that they literally lash out.
Jon Stewart, host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. By TIAA Cref, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good. TIAA-CREF.org. And from the German Information Center, celebrating the Day of German Unity October 3rd. GIC on the web at germany.unity.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, making David and Goliath jokes, we continue our conversation with Jon Stewart, host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. And Jeff Nunberg considers how we think about the internet and the words we use to describe it.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest is comedian Jon Stewart, host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. He and The Daily Show writers have a new book called America, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. It seems that a fair amount of what you do, I think, is being a watchdog on the journalistic community. And there was one more clip I wanted to play. This is of you taking on the conservative columnist Bob Novak. This is Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. Let's give this a listen.
One of our favorite journalists in the country, in fact, that I wanted to talk to you about, his name is Bob Novak. Novak, of course, most well known for heroically publishing the identity of an active CIA agent, which I thought sent a clear message to the world saying, if that's what we'll do to our own spies, imagine, just imagine what we'll do to yours. That's right. That's right. We'll out them too, as we've seen. Well, our man Novak is at it again. He has a little editorial in the Washington Post. We talked a little yesterday about this new ad by a group called Swift Boat Veterans for Truth that attempts to discredit or undercut or, what's the word I'm looking for? Get on. John Kerry's actions in Vietnam. We'd implied that the ad was a low blow, perhaps produced by those angry at Kerry for his post-war protest activities that they've never gotten over, and that in the absence of any evidence, the only response necessary was delivered at the Democratic Convention when Kerry's Swift Boat mates stood with him on stage in support. But Novak has shown me I'm wrong. Yesterday's Washington Post featured an interesting editorial by Novak saying, maybe we are not giving this group a fair shake. Unfit for command sends a devastating message unless it is effectively refuted. Because in this country, when a scurrilous charge is made against you by people, you're guilty. Unless you prove otherwise, that's how it works. Kudos, Robert Novak. You truly are a douchebag of liberty.
Jon Stewart on The Daily Show talking about columns Bob Novak. You know,
Bob Novak, you know, he shouldn't even be allowed on TV. He should be in jail.
In jail.
There's no reason why he should be on TV.
Why should he be in jail?
For giving away the identity of an active CIA agent working on weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, hiding behind all kinds of secretive and you know, freedom of the press issues.
You know, I guess we should note that we've played some clips here which are pretty tough on conservatives and Republicans, but mm-hmm. The Daily Show certainly takes its whack at others. And you've been very funny about John Kerry and his own unique style. And I didn't have a clip, but I thought maybe you might just give us a riff on what would John Kerry say about your book, America?
Well, the thing about John Kerry that I think is important for everybody to remember is that, you know, people have said that this election is over. But if he focuses, if he really buckles down, he can defeat Nixon and hopefully have our troops out of Vietnam by 74. Bring it on. I think the issue with Kerry is that the more he tries to have people like him, I think what he doesn't understand is, and again, this is, I think, a failing of politics in general, is there's a certain, when people are running for president, they all of a sudden want to be us. There's this sense of, I'm just like you. I'm a regular Joe. I watch 12 hours of TV a day. Like, you don't. What I wish a president would come out and say is this: I'm better than you. I'm much better than you. I'm much smarter than you. I've studied for this my whole life. I understand how to fix this country. I don't want somebody like me. Why don't I be president then? Right. So I think his problem is that he has decided to turn against what is clearly, I mean, that is, if anyone has ever been raised in a laboratory to become president, it's Kerry. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's from day one, I'm sure, you know, at 3 years old, he got his My First White House kit. You know, he is a guy that is clearly, and now that he is finally in the race to be president, he has decided that what it really is a likable average Joe. And it so clearly goes against his constitution.
My guest is Jon Stewart. He is the host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central and the author with his writers of America, the Book, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action.
You know, I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. You know, people talk about you know, there's a lot of fun made of the Republicans. One of the things that, you know, you have to look at is who controls everything. Because that's really, when you're doing a show that's based on current events, it's very hard. You know, there's been this, the Republicans have the House, the Senate, and the executive branch. And we learned the Supreme Court. Who else are you going to make fun of? It's the, if you're a comedian, you know, there's a lot of Goliath jokes out there. But, yeah, you know, the David stuff never really went over.
Right. Tom Daschle's not a big enough target, huh?
He's just not, it's not even that he's a big enough target, it's that he's not there.
Right.
There is no there. There isn't anything to make fun of. You know, how much can you make fun of a guy who's just getting crushed, who basically has to stoop to putting on a commercial with him hugging President Bush? I mean, it'd be like Sammy Davis Jr. running an ad with him and Nixon. You know, it doesn't make any sense.
Right. So Democrats, be warned. Your day is coming if you win.
Well, they're not going to win until the rapture. You know, the interesting thing is when the rapture comes and all the believers are sucked up into heaven, that's, I believe, when the Democrats will retake the House and the Senate.
Wow, that's a long time.
But even then, they'll probably have a fight with the Green Party.
Right. Having spent so much time watching these two candidates, dissecting their ideas and style, what advice would you give them as they approach their first debate?
What advice would I give them?
Yeah, what?
I think the advice that I would probably give is not so much to the candidates, but to the moderators.
Okay.
Which is, do your best to make this a real event and not just one more loyalty oath signed, staged campaign photo op from inside the bubble. Do your best to try and put yourself in the position of the American public on the outside of the bubble and try to get an answer, try and get them off, try and get a human moment that will somehow reveal the stagecraft or something behind what we're seeing. That would be my advice, because that's, to me, that would be the only thing that would be worthwhile out of these debates. I mean, the truth is, the postscripts have already been written, unless something dramatic happens. It's already been written that Kerry seemed to have a grasp of the issues, but he did have trouble defending his flip-floppery. But Bush, you know, he's so eloquently simple. He's just the kind of guy you want to have a beer with, and he's just one of those guys. It's just great. It's just great. And Kerry, for all his knowledge and expertise, is he's too Hessian. He's too European. You know, so all the – but get them off their stupid talking points and their just absolutely manicured, manufactured, put-on personas.
You know, you've written this book.
It's got pictures. You always got to throw that in there.
It's got a lot of pictures and a foreword by Thomas Jefferson. I mean, I think that's a measure of your stature.
Yes. And by the way, man, did I have to edit that. Boy, talk about long-winded.
No kidding.
I was like, TJ, it's the foreword. Ease up, buddy.
You know, once you're a founding father, you think you can just go on and on.
You know what? And here's the other thing. He wanted to call it a preamble.
Oh, no.
It's not a preamble. It's just not done anymore.
Yeah, yeah. How do you want people to use this book? I mean, if there's some exercises in it for kids and the like.
Yeah, I think what we want is for people to read it, to do the exercises, to do the work. It's like Phil McGraw. You know, when he writes a book, he wants you to do the exercises, to improve yourself. You know, this is for people that are going to found a country. And we think that, you know, and again, I think people need to realize that basically there are no frontier lands anymore. We basically have mapped and GPSed pretty much everything there is to map and GPS.
Right.
But there are a lot of countries that are broken. And so I think you can go into countries that are already broken and still refound them. And I think if you do all the exercises in the book, you will find that you are qualified to some extent to found and lead that democracy. And I say this with, you know, again, nobody's perfect. You could follow this instructions in the book step by step and still end up with a country that, you know, is a plutocracy. You don't know. But I guarantee you, if you use the ideas in the book, just smash them together randomly, you'll come out with something better than North Korea.
What an inspiring thought. Gosh.
Absolutely.
And you get a free poster of the upcoming battle in this election, which you call the Thrilla in Vanilla.
Yes.
George W. Bush and John Kerry without their shirts.
Skull versus bones.
It's great.
Yeah. Thank you. And the other side of that is the shadow government, which teaches you about the government underground that actually controls the things. And if you don't want to know about it, if you don't want to have your mind blown, if you don't want to face reality, you don't have to look at it. You don't have to look at the shadow government that secretly controls all that you are.
It's all there, folks.
Oh, it's there, baby. It's out there.
You know, this is not your... People will be surprised. This is not your first book. You wrote a book, Naked Pictures of Famous People. Which
that is correct.
It really wasn't. It was a series of sort of kind of satiric essays.
My favorite essay in the book is, I think, Hitler on Larry King, which was always one of my favorites.
Tell us a little about that.
It's about Hitler and Larry King. It's about sort of the culture of no matter what you do, no matter how poorly you perform, no matter how you disappoint the public, no matter what crimes against humanity you have committed, if you go on Larry King and say you're sorry, all is forgiven, and you're welcomed back into the community of man. So it's about Hitler sort of coming to grips with his inner dictator and writing a book called Mein Comfortable Shoes, sort of about acceptance. And, the first thing is he comes on to Larry King, and he's eating a bagel with a schmear, and he says, first of all, I just want to say these are delicious. I don't know what I was so afraid of. Then it just sort of goes on from there, and it's as tasteless as it sounds.
All right. My guest is Jon Stewart. He is the host of Comedy Central's Daily Show, and he and his crew have a new book out, America the Book, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with comedian Jon Stewart. He is host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. You grew up in Lawrenceville, New Jersey.
That is correct.
Were you a class clown? Did you have this sort of persona that made fun of everybody in a kind of playful and endearing way?
Yes, I was very playful and
that
endearing.
Was you.
I was an imp. I was on the smallish side, and yet my head is the size it is now. I looked like a Peanuts character, is what I'm trying to say, except with acne. You can imagine I was very popular.
Yeah, must have been a great benefit.
I was always very proud in high school. I was voted best sense of humor and not class clown, and I always thought there was a very big distinction there, even though I'm not quite sure what it is. But I think that early on, people always say, when did you realize you were funny? And I think it's not that you realize you were funny. It's that your brain works in a certain way.
Hmm.
And I don't think that that's... I think in some respects it's uncontrollable, and you can either accept it and deal with it and hone it, or you can try and fight it. And I was too weak to fight it. And so I just sort of went with it. And the big thing to learn was how to turn obnoxiousness into wit. And that was the hardest, probably, lesson. Obnoxiousness is what gets your butt kicked. And wit is what makes people go, oh, that's endearing. And it's trying not to get your butt kicked while still having your brain work in the way that you're comfortable with.
What do you mean by your brain works in a different way?
It, for some reason, defaults to a joke. I don't know why it does that. It certainly isn't helpful. It didn't help me keep any other job other than this one. But for some reason, it always looks to mischief.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I didn't do any theater or anything like that when I was younger, but we did do one senior year in high school. We were in a play called The Pajama Game. And our first night performing it at the high school in front of a full crowd, and everybody took it very seriously, and rightfully so. My friends and I were in the chorus. We did Steam Heat, very powerful version, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one scene at a picnic where the two lovers finally come together at the front of the stage, and they're alone on stage, and it's in front of a backdrop of trees. And as they were out there, just about to begin this beautiful duet, I wandered out and put my back to the audience and pretended I was relieving myself on one of the trees. Now, as you can imagine, the crowd found this somewhat amusing. The two actors on stage, not so much. The director of the play, again, sided with the actors, not so much. Me, I thought, oh my God, I'm killing. This is awesome. This play is going great. And this is what I'm suggesting to you, is that it's learning when to use it, how to use it, but by God, there's nothing else you can do. It's just some reason in any situation it occurs to you that wouldn't it be funny if? And that's that.
Right. You went to college, William and Mary, and right. I read that you were 23 when you had a job with the state of New Jersey and, you know, looking forward to a reasonably happy life with a car and, you know, making your way through the world. And you decided to go to New York and do stand-up. And at first just got brutalized, as people do. And I'm wondering, you know, there are lots of people who are funny that make their friends laugh, make their family laugh. And then when they get on stage and try and make an audience laugh, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, that was me.
What is it? I mean, you were so funny. You had that brain working that way. What was it you didn't know?
What was it I didn't know about which?
About why didn't it work? Why is being funny with your friends not the same thing as...
Well, because it's a craft. You know, it isn't... There's a big difference between having an analytical mind and being a good scientist. There is a craft to learn. And that was the biggest lesson, is that it takes, again, it's that idea of turning obnoxiousness into wit or comedy. You know, creating something from nothing is different from just being reactive at a bar. And you have to create the atmospheric conditions for comedy. Comedy is, oddly enough, very fragile and can be thrown off by, you know, a glass breaking or somebody talking, or, you know, there's a lot of different elements to it that... And construction of a joke, you know, you have to create. One of the things about being funny in life is the premise is already there.
Right.
Typically, when you're with your friends, premises are coming up left and right. But when you're on stage, you must create the premise. So you have to create the premise, paint the picture, and then deliver the punchline. You have to take them from their, you know, sitting, you know, their lack of movement. You take them from zero to laughter. Whereas in life, all that inertia is already presented, and you're just deflecting it. Being funny in life is a lot more like, you know, judo. It's using the energy that's coming at you to your advantage.
Right.
Doing stand-up comedy is in the middle of a traffic jam, getting everybody moving again. You know, it's a totally different skill and environment, and one that is learned.
Right. Now, it's been reported that Conan O'Brien's job is going to open up in 2009. I mean, this is a transition befitting a Stalinist era dictatorship. But you know, I mean, people who see you do what you do wonder. I mean, you're inevitably headed for a big network show. What do you think?
Oh, I am scheduled to take over from Ted Koppel in 2019.
Wow.
So that has been, we have talked about that. Actually, it's not even going to be from Ted Koppel. It's going to be from the Ted Koppel 3000, which is a Ted Koppel simulator that they've been developing in the basement.
Like the HAL 9000, right?
That's exactly right. It's right now, it's just a head and a couple of circuit boards. But they're working hard, and with the right batteries and semiconductors, you know, fingers crossed, 2019, you'll see me.
That's your day.
But either that or I'll just bring back solid gold. You know, I've got a lot of plans. I've got a lot of things I want to try.
Well, John Stewart, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
John Stewart, host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. Their new book is called America, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. Tonight, The Daily Show features a live broadcast at 11 o'clock Eastern Time following the first presidential debate. Coming up, Jeff Nunberg on The Way We Talk About the Web. This is Fresh Air. Should we capitalize the words internet and web or not? Maybe it's a question only a linguist or a copy editor would ask, but as our own linguist Jeff Nunberg reports, it's one that has a lot of techies worked up.
Most people didn't take much notice when Wired magazine announced recently that they decided to drop the capital letter on internet and web. But the news had the techies burning the midnight phosphor. Bloggers reacted indignantly, and there were more than 800 comments posted on Slashdot.org, the site that serves geeks as a digital water cooler. Of course, you'd expect the Slashdot crowd to be a little anal about stylistic matters. That comes with a job. Misplace a comma in an email or an op-ed piece, and you only risk losing your reader's attention. Misplace a comma in a line of software code, and you risk losing everything on your hard disk. Still, this wasn't just one of those meaningless stylebook niceties like whether to capitalize the Y in Your Eminence. It has to do with how we think about the internet itself. Back in the 1920s, people sometimes capitalized the radio and the cinema, but they stopped doing that when the media receded into the cultural background. That's what led Wired to go to the lowercase form of internet. As the editors put it, it was a way of acknowledging that the internet is simply another medium for delivering and receiving information. I wish Wired luck, but they're fighting an uphill battle. People seem attached to the capitalized forms of internet and the web, not just in the press, but on the web itself and in the internet discussion groups. And a lot of newspapers were capitalizing blogosphere last week in their stories about the role that bloggers had played in discrediting those CBS memos about President Bush's National Guard service. People seem to think of these words on the model of other common nouns that have been elevated to proper names, like the Shire, the Channel, or the Coast. They want to think of the internet as a place. We've been talking about the internet in a spatial way since the early days of cyberspace, which was always depicted as an open expanse like an ocean, a plane, or a galaxy. And that spatial conception persisted even as settlers started to stake out the territory and the geography acquired features more typical of urban architecture like portals, gateways, and sites. But whether you picture the internet on the model of the Great Plains or the Bowery, the idea of it as a space is built into the language we use to talk about it. Visit, go to, those aren't verbs we use when we're talking about reading a newspaper article or tuning in the evening news. The spatial picture of the internet is one of those metaphorical frames that makes a technology easier to comprehend. It's like the trash can icon on the computer desktop, a useful analogy, so long as you don't think that the sanitation guys are going to be clanging by on Tuesday morning to dump it out for you. But there's a difference between saying something is a space and saying it's a particular place. There's no reason why we shouldn't think of the internet as one of those ubiquitous presences like the atmosphere or the cosmos. None of them phrases we're tempted to put in capital letters. Putting a capital I on internet implies something more than that. It turns the internet into a specific location, a city of bits where a single community is taking shape. You can hear that picture in the phrases that cyber visionaries like to toss around when they're talking about the online community. Emerging consciousness, social contract, netizens, collective mind. Or as one of them put it in a much-publicized manifesto, "I come from cyberspace, the new home of mind. On behalf of the future, I ask you of the past to leave us alone. You do not know us. You have not engaged in our great and gathering conversation. You do not know our culture, our ethics, or our unwritten codes." Listening to that, your first thought is apt to be, what do you mean, we? In fact, the internet is no more a coherent community than the collection of travelers who happen to find themselves at Kennedy Airport on a given Monday afternoon on their way to or from Stuttgart, San Juan, or St. Louis. If the internet permits the illusion of community, it's only because we don't actually have to rub elbows with most of the other travelers there. We move around it the way Donald Trump cruises around New York, alighting from the limo only when we pull up at a destination full of people like us. But it's a little delusional to talk about the group mind of a collectivity that can't even reach a consensus on the correct spelling of accommodate. Or if you need a further demonstration, log in to one of the sites called Voyeurs, which throw up a random selection of queries as they come into the search engines. Cape May Hotels, Anna Kournikova, Pro-Death Penalty, Humping, Mapa de Caracas, Aston Kutcher Filmography, Bush Deception, Loans Until Payday, Fish Jokes, Israel Atrocities, Anna Kournikova, Dogs Getting It, Funeral Prayers. Taken together, it makes for a strange kind of poésie concrète. But if that's the product of a collective mind, it's a mighty scattered one. All the more reason for writing internet with a lowercase I. It reminds you that there really is no out there out there.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, publisher of Fortress America, On the Front Lines of Homeland Security, an inside look at the coming surveillance state by Matthew Brzezinski. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor James Earl Jones. Before he was the ominous voice of Darth Vader, he was a kid with a stutter. He's now among those immortalized in a new Star Wars trilogy DVD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.